Campylobacter, E. coli, hepatitis A, listeria, norovirus, salmonella, shigella. Just some that lead us to ask, is food becoming safe to eat, less safe to eat, or will food always be unsafe to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,107th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Aberdeen who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Jason.
It's a pleasure.
Are you a fan of Chipotle?
I am a huge fan of Chipotle.
A huge fan.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then we have a huge radio show for you.
Yes.
Folks, when we last spoke with attorney Bill Marler on the Food Chain Radio Show, it was way back there in edition number 631, which is like 476 weeks ago, give or take a day off now and then. We talked about some pending legislation called the Food Safety Modernization Act and whether the legislation would make food safe from the dread pathogens that can sicken and even kill us. In the 9-plus years since, Attorney Bill has won a lot of money, over $600 million, wow, suing those who sell bad food to good people. Well, goodness sakes, he is now locking horns with Chipotle, which, as we all have heard, sickened people across the land with its contaminated foods. And so we got to wondering about the Food Safety Modernization Act that weaponized the Food and Drug Administration, turning it into a police state of food production, and that wondering leads us to ask, is our food becoming safe to eat, less safe to eat, or will food always be unsafe to eat? Who better to ask than the man who makes his living with unsafe food, Bill Marler, who is the partner with Marler and Clark Law Firm up in Seattle. Bill, welcome back.
Nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, it's good to be back and talking about food safety with a man who probably knows about more about food safety than just about anybody I could think of, because you've made your living with it for quite a few years now. Quick question. How did you come to specialize in food safety issues?
25 years ago, the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak happened. If you remember.
I remember that.
Yep. You know, about 700 people sickened. 4 children died. It really was, you know, a seminal moment in food safety, I think, for, you know, for everyone. And it was sort of the beginning of, you know, my career representing victims of foodborne illness. And basically that's what I've been doing since then. And, you know, it's taken me to, you know, nearly every state. And I now spend about, a third to 40% of my time, giving, talks about food safety all over the world. And I just got back from a trip to St. Louis, Houston. I'm off to Portland, Maine tomorrow, and then to New Zealand at the end of the week.
Lots of running around.
Yep.
It's a big issue, though, all over the world, is it not? And I guess, you know, looking back at that Jack in the Box incident, it was kind of indicative of the fact that we now live in a world where, you know, one company's bad food can get everybody everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things I, you know, tell businesses, because most of the people I speak to are, you know, business conferences and business leaders, and, you know, about why it's a bad idea to poison your customer. And, you know, the...
Let me guess.
But, you know, the reality is that the supply chain for food has become incredibly complex. You know, if you look back to, you know, one of the first times, you know, we spoke was, you know, after the, you know, the horrible incident, the spinach and the E. coli outbreak.
Right.
And, you know, and how, you know, mass produced food has such great opportunities not only to feed people but to, and feed them safely, but you just have to be incredibly careful about, you know, everything from where the product's being grown, how the product's being washed or manufactured, and then, you know, shipping the product across the United States, and how that impacts, you know, all those aspects of food safety. It can become incredibly complex.
And that spinach incident of which you speak was probably the incident that precipitated the effort to develop the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2010. And what exactly did we do when we put that on the table?
Well, I think you have to put it, you're partly correct. And I think you put it in sort of historical context. And I've been, you know, sort of at the, you know, the side table since the early 90s on food safety policy in the U.S. And, you know, much of what was put together in both the House and the Senate version on the Food Safety Modernization Act were ideas that really began out of the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak. Much of the various sections of the Food Safety Modernization Act were, you know, in a sense, on the shelf in Senate offices and House offices in the 90s and early 2000s, and it was, you know, sort of waiting for the right, in a sense, the right disaster to, as you know, no. You know, every disaster needs a solution, and it's the right disaster, and those things were plugged and played off, you know, Senate and House shelves.
So there.
The owner, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, there it was. The spinach incident said, okay, here we go again, so are we going to do something about it? And the
exactly.
folks that inhabit Washington, D.C. said, yes, we have something to do. So it was really kind of a rush job. It seemed to me they passed it. I think it was like in the closing hours of 2010. It was like midnight or something on the 31st.
There's some pretty good stories behind that. And, you know, if we had a couple hours, I could tell you them. But, you know, the House version was passed in July of 2009 with wide, wide bipartisan support. It was probably, I would say it's got to be the last piece of bipartisan legislation that's happened in the last, you know, yeah. almost a decade.
We agree on something. Holy yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, you know, the Republicans, Democrats, farm state, you know, non-farm state. It was passed, you know, overwhelmingly in the House. It got hung up in the Senate, really for partisan reasons, primarily because of the toxicity of the fight over Obamacare, you know, changed the political landscape and dynamic in the Senate.
Oh.
And so what happened was when the Republicans were taking over the Senate and in the waning days of 2009, and everything got pushed through. It was, you know, the lame duck session, and mm-hmm. you know, lots of legislation got pushed through, including the Food Safety Modernization Act. So yeah, sort of rushed, but not because, you know, the House and Senate versions were, you know, essentially, you know, nearly identical.
Well, the Food Safety Modernization Act, of course, was designed to give the federal government, police powers over our food, and their job was to make food safe. But if they had made food safe, what would Bill Marler be doing?
Well, that, you know, I wrote an op-ed, and I know that I wrote an op-ed in 2002 regarding focused on the beef industry, that, you know, if you don't like lawyers, and, you know, if you look at the statistics, most people don't like lawyers, and, you know, maybe for good reasons, but, you know, if you don't like lawyers, you know, do something about, you know, hamburger safety. And here's a really, I think it's a very interesting statistic, and I think we're starting to see that play out in leafy greens as well. But from 1993 to 2002, about 95% of my law firm revenue was E. coli cases linked to hamburger.
Wow.
And that's nearly zero now. And it's not like somebody else is doing it. But what happened was, you know, post-Jack in the Box, you know, the federal government, Mike Taylor, you may remember from food safety, from the FDA. Mike Taylor was head of Food Safety Inspection Services. He implemented zero tolerance for E. coli in hamburger, implemented HACCP, and, you know, the industry screamed and police state, all upset. You know, there were litigation between the industry and
but
the government.
But yet they are putting you out of business with respect to the E. coli in hamburger.
Yep, it's a remarkable
achievement.
Thing.
Okay, when we get back, Bill, I'd like to take you and talk about engineer Jason Struby's favorite place, which of course is Chipotle. What happened at Chipotle? That's a real head scratcher to me. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with attorney Bill Marler. Today we're talking about food safety. Is our food safe? What do you think? 831-479-1980. Right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it. Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it. Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it. Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it. Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it. Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, hopefully we are eating good food, but sometimes we don't. I certainly remember one time I ate some bad food. It was a multi-course meal in Hong Kong, and along about, you know, the dish number 37 or something, some raw fish came through, and in the second I swallowed it, I knew I was toast, and I was toast. So it happens, and it happens all over the world. But if I were a food safety attorney looking for business, if I were going to start my own business right now, I'd just go down to the cruise ship dock and wait for those guys to sail back in. And I'd just sit there with a little card table and a sign that says, sign you up. Bill, wouldn't that be a good thing to do? I mean, it seems like cruise ships are always coming down.
Yeah, doing what you've described would be unethical. But beside the point, I mean, most of the people on cruise ships, you know, they're, you know, AKA norovirus factories. I mean, norovirus is the biggest foodborne illness problem in the United States. It's becoming, some of it's becoming much more virulent, and it's a big concern because it's so easily transmitted. You know, we saw that problem with Chipotle.
So it's a virus, it's not a bacteria.
Correct. And it's, so it's very easily transmitted. You know, it can be airborne. So it's also really difficult sometimes to parse out whether or not it's foodborne or environmental. You know, there have been outbreaks linked to those plastic balls in, you know, kid fun houses. You know,
oh boy!
Yeah.
And it comes from fecal matter, right?
It's a human virus.
It's a human virus.
It's a human virus. It's in your vomit. I mean, that when you get sick. So it's,
So if you get sick and throw up, you're
It's not pleasant. But you know, one thing I wanted to sort of finish with respect to the success of the meat industry putting me out of business is that you know, if you want to look at where we've come with respect to leafy greens, I think we maybe it's still a little too early to tell, but I see those same things happening. And you know, if you look back in the early part of 2000, As the meat industry was getting their act together and I was running out of work, the leafy green industry was, you know, recall after recall after outbreak after outbreak. And when the spinach, there were a couple big spinach, one big spinach, a couple lettuce outbreaks in 05, 06, 07, leafy green marketing agreement came into being, you know, the folks at UC Davis started doing, you know, really great work. And, you know, that really formed the basis of the, some of the, you know, FSMA rules that, you know, you sort of mentioned as draconian. But, you know, the industry has really stepped up and, you know, it's, we are, and still maybe too early to, you know, spike the ball, but I think we're starting to see, you know, a lot less outbreaks linked to E. coli and Salmonella in leafy greens, and you know, that's a great thing.
Well, it would seem to me that you're probably you and the people like you, the attorneys like you, are a big reason that the industry is stepping up. Because if they don't step up, they know that they're going to be subject to some very expensive litigation, and that'll raise the cost of their goods and services, and it'll make them less competitive. So, you know, when they see Bill Marler coming, I give sweep the floor. You know,
I think that is part of it. But you know, I've never been, you know, egotistical enough to think that that's really all of it. I think it's a combination of things. I think when you look at some of the, you know, and the, you know, LGMA did some great work with some, you know, victims of E. coli. They did some great videos and talked about how important food safety is by focusing on, you know, what can happen to a consumer. You know, kidney failure, brain injury, transplant, all that. So I think it's partly, you know, the business loss. I mean, it took a long time for the spinach industry to recover. So I think it's a combination of moral reasons. Don't poison your customer because they're a little kid. There's business reasons, both in the economic loss and, you know, the litigation costs. And so I think it's a combination of one thing or another, but it's certainly not, you know, it's not all because I'm suing people.
No, but it helps, I think. Speaking of losing business, let's turn to Chipotle. In 2015, it suffered an incredible series of contaminations, but it was only the fifth largest food contamination, foodborne illness incident in 2015. So it wasn't really even one of the biggest ones.
I think if you look at all of the outbreaks they had, and I think that's kind of important that, you know, maybe your listeners don't know just how much problems they had in
dozen states, coast to coast.
Well, this is the history of it. They had an unnamed E. coli outbreak in Seattle in July of 2015. Five people sick, never got reported by public health. We just sort of stumbled upon it. We sort of stumbled upon it because people contacted us, and as we researched it, found out that it was linked to Chipotle by genetics, by everything.
Sequencing the genes.
Yeah. Then they had a Salmonella outbreak linked to tomatoes in Minneapolis. Then they had the E. coli outbreak that kind of was multi-state, lots of people sick. Then they had a norovirus outbreak in California, and then they had a norovirus outbreak in Boston. So their 2015 was as bad as you could get. I mean, it was, and you know, their stock price went from 725 to under 400, and it's kind of bouncing back a little bit, but I think it's probably hovering, you know, just above, you know, maybe 400, 425.
Well, our engineer is going back there and eating, so they must be doing okay. Well, when I look at that incident of the Chipotle, it just seemed it was too much. It was too bad. You know, it wasn't just that it was bad. And it was that so many could be sickened in so many different restaurants mm-hmm. across such a broad geographical area by mm-hmm. so many different toxins in such a short period of time. Mm-hmm. I just shake my head and go, it looks to me like sabotage.
Oh, no, that's, you know, conspiracy theories don't, you know, hold much water to me, but it would be impossible to do, you know, that sort of broad, you know, thing, and there's absolutely no evidence to support it.
Okay.
However, you know, I really think what, you know, Chipotle, and I was involved in all of those cases, by the way, so mm-hmm. I dug very deep into
it. Yeah, so you were right there, right?
Yeah, and so I think the reality is that Chipotle was focused in many respects on potentially admirable things, you know, non-antibiotics,
ethical food,
non-GMO, yeah. happy cows, that kind of stuff. You know, and whether that's good or bad from one's perspective, I think that's a sort of more of a political statement. But they were more focused on that than they were on food safety.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, Bill. But when we come back, we'll pick up Chipotle and ask Bill Marler, who was right there with his eyes and ears right in the middle of it all, what the heck happened? How could so many restaurants across such a broad geographical area be contaminated with so many different kinds of pathogens in infecting so many different people? This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, with attorney Bill Marler and you. We are at 831-479-1980. If you would care to participate in our conversation today, do you think our food is getting safer than it was? Do you think it is not getting safer? Do you think it can ever be safe? We will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What is we're eating food, and we're eating lots of it, and it's come from all over the world, and sometimes it isn't such good food to eat, and we get into a lot of trouble. One of those occasions occurred at the Chipotle restaurant chain, wherein restaurants across the country, in a very short period of time, all came down with different kinds of food poisonings. And Bill Marler was there in the thick of things. And so we're wondering just exactly how did that happen, Bill?
Well, if you look at, each outbreak individually, you know, you've got the two norovirus outbreaks, which were the largest, one in Simi Valley, California, one in Boston, you know, combined sickened almost 400 people. Those were linked directly to ill employees who were working with norovirus. Mm-hmm. And it's very easily transmitted. The salmonella outbreak was linked to salmonella-tainted tomatoes that made it to Minnesota, and it was multiple restaurants in Minnesota. The, you know, E. coli outbreak that was not reported in Seattle was a 5-person E. coli outbreak over a 2-day period of time. You know, likely linked to an ingredient that was contaminated with E. coli. And if you look at the larger E. coli outbreak, which was about 60 people in multiple states, the E. coli 026 outbreak, that was, I think, most likely a meat product that was in common with all of those stores that was undercooked. And so, you know, I mean,
you're suggesting it's kind of like a cascade of complacency on the part of Chipotle and its employees. It just somehow all happened at the same place in the same time. And you express skepticism as to the notion of conspiracy.
Right.
But there was a conspiracy with respect to food in the Dalles, Oregon, when a local religious commune decided to win the local election by poisoning everybody, all the people who were going to vote. And they did. They were caught, of course, but they did succeed in poisoning a lot of people.
Yep. Yeah, actually, it was I wasn't, college, undergrad at the time, when that happened. But I've learned a lot about that outbreak. And, yeah, they were basically making salmonella back at the commune and then taking it out in spray bottles and spraying it on salad bars. So, I mean, these things can happen, and I think you have to pay attention mm-hmm. to it. But fortunately, these sorts of things are very few and far between.
Sure.
They can look. Yeah, and I think one of the things that Health and Human Services Director Tommy Thompson under the Bush administration, you know, warned about bioterrorism in our food supply, and it will look a lot like a foodborne illness outbreak. And so there's lots of reasons to pay attention to foodborne illness outbreaks, and, you know, bioterrorism is one of those.
Well, good enough. You know, I just looked at the Chipotle and saw all the coincidence, and I saw the fact that Chipotle was just cleaning up in with respect to the restaurant industry. It was just mm-hmm. booming, and it was booming because it was selling ethical food, and people wanted ethical food. But that's to say that we have ethical food and you don't.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think that it was just sort of lack of focus. And again, I'll give you an example, slightly different spin, but I'll give you an example. You know, during the Jack in the Box E. coli outbreak, you know, they had warning from the state of Washington in early part of 1992, so several months before the outbreak, that the Washington state had increased their cook temp for hamburgers from 140 to 155 requirement. And Jack in the Box essentially ignored that. And they ignored it because their 2-minute cook time was more important to be consistent in all restaurants across the United States. And to get to 155, they would have had to increase the cook time to 2 minutes and 10 seconds. And they weren't willing to do that. Hmm. And so sometimes, you know, your reason for being fast food or ethical food can turn around and bite you when it relates to food safety. And I think that's the lesson that can be learned, you know, by every food producer, every restaurant, every grocery store chain.
It's kind of like another way of saying that there's a reason that all those other restaurants weren't serving ethical food, because it's a pain in the butt to serve ethical food.
Well, I think there's a combination that can be done, and, you know, but, you know, there's a reason why, you know, Chipotle now is switching. They've hired some very good people, many of whom I suggested to them to hire, some very good people in food safety, to, you know, come in and take a really strong look at their food safety procedures, and, you know, they're implementing them. Mm-hmm. And I think the likelihood of Chipotle seeing this kind of problem in, of 2015 again is going to be quite low.
I think somebody mentioned one of the smartest things a fast service restaurant could do would be to put a video camera over the wash basin in the restroom. I don't know. Could be. You know, let's switch gears a little bit here. If anybody knows about food safety and what's good to eat and what's not, it would certainly be you, and you've come out with a list of things that you'd never eat. And, oh, my goodness, it's really depressing.
Well, you know.
And it's depressing, of course, because there's most of the things I love to eat.
Well, you know, there's, I think these lists are, you know, they're never perfect. But, you know, the certainly what I think about is the risk, primarily, not necessarily to, you know, a healthy, happy 50-something-year-old guy like me, but it's, you know, the risk really is to the very young, you know, the very old and the immune-compromised folks.
Sure.
And that's the sort of the big focus, I think, that food...
Well, you know, that leads me to a question my wife was asking. She said, you, speaking to me, love raw milk. And I can't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because I don't have the enzymes or something, but I can't drink it. And I love it. Why is that? I mean, doesn't that have a... Why do 5 people get sick eating in a Chipotle in Seattle and everybody else Does it?
Yeah. I mean, it could be. There's probably as many reasons as we have hours in the day to chat about it. But, you know, for example, E. coli 0157, which is the nasty form, you know, somewhere between 10 and 50 bacterium is enough to make you sick. And 100,000 of them would fit on the head of a pin. So, you know, one of the answers to the question is, you know, why doesn't everybody in the restaurant get sick? Is, you know, frankly, because the E. coli is not uniformly spread on all the food, and it may just be in one pocket in one little area of some food item. It could also be, you know, how much acid you happen to have in your stomach at a given time.
And so on and so on.
Your immune system. It's all a combination. It's these outbreaks happen because of a cascading, you know, wrong place, the wrong time sort of scenario.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jenny has a question about farm worker hand washing. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Bill Marler, Marler Clark Law Firm in Seattle, and you, 831-479-1080.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, one of the things we love to eat, we shouldn't eat, at least according to attorney Bill Marler's don't eat these six things list. Number two on the list, of course, is pre-cut fruits and vegetables. How easy they are to eat. Oh, my goodness. But that takes us to Jenny, who has a question that will be the perfect segue. Jenny, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I remember around the 70s, and maybe there was even after, a little bit after the 70s, but I remember it was common to see wooden structures that were toilets out in the fields. That's the only way farm workers would have access to going to the bathroom. Okay, but you never, I mean, there was never any stringent, employers didn't even have water to wash their hands with. I don't know if they even had toilet paper, and you never heard, and a lot of people listened to the radio back in those days, more so than now, and you never heard about outbreaks of E. coli or whatever. The first I heard about E. coli was about an outbreak with cantaloupes. Now, those cantaloupes came from other parts, maybe Arizona, I'm not sure, but so it was after Cesar Chavez came in that more laws were put into place for sanitation. So you mentioned a word of sabotage, and, you know, it could be. It's like it seems like all of a sudden after Chipotle there was more outbreaks here, outbreaks there, outbreaks there. And nowadays, even when the outbreak of Chipotle was happening, farm workers were required to wash their hands. The sanitation laws were there. So that's something to think about. So has your guest investigated why, I mean, the statistics compared to now as to in the 70s and before about the outbreaks of certain drugs?
Jenny, that's an awfully interesting question. Just thinking about it, I don't recall mass foodborne cases, you know, growing up.
Right.
Bill?
That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, no. There were lots of foodborne illness outbreaks that occurred, you know, in the 1900s. Much of it related to consumption of raw milk, which is one of the reasons why pasteurization came into being.
Oh, okay.
And so, but one of the things that has happened is, you know, if you look back, you look back to the statistics for E. coli 0157, and it's basically non-existent until 1993, and then it spikes through the roof, and then, you know, has slowly declined over time. And the reason why is it didn't all of a sudden just show up in 1993. It's just that we weren't testing for it. So one of the reasons why, that we know more now is that we're testing product more. We're testing humans more. We're finding things that were most likely already there for a long time. But, you know, kids were dying of kidney failure. Kids were dying of bloody diarrhea. And nobody knew why. And so it's really a combination of, you know, scientific progression that we're learning these things. We're now then learning how to combat them, and we're starting to see positive impacts in both in hamburger. We're starting to see the same thing in leafy greens. So, you know, science is a good thing. Science and, you know, causation and is a good thing.
We know more. Therefore, we know we're sicker more than we thought we were before.
Absolutely.
Debbie, you're a health inspector?
Yes.
Well, welcome.
Hi. I have some comments. I'm just down in the area just for a minute and heading out. But I've been a health inspector since 2004. And one thing I can tell you is that, you know, there are some good inspectors, but there's a lot of things that are missed, and they're routinely missed. And, you know, I know that they're trying to do some standardization in trying to get inspectors to do the same job, but what I see out in the field is quite often, actually, is the gloss over, the not refreshing on the law, the incorrect holding temperatures of hot, or actually mostly of cold foods is what I see. I see that a caller mentioned earlier about cut fruit, or it was something that was being read. You see it all the time. You see cut watermelon, cut cantaloupe. They put it maybe on partially on ice in a plastic cup, and that does not hold temperature. So, you know, there's sometimes I think the inspectors allow ice instead of mechanical refrigeration, which, you know, if you really read the law, it's not allowed unless they go through a certain procedure. They have to throw away the food and yada, yada. But I can...
Well, let me ask, Debbie, let me ask you a quick question. We have to go to a break in just a minute here. But I'd like to ask you, do you feel as a health inspector that you're under pressure sometime to bend the rules to make it easier for people to stay in business?
I would never succumb to that. I think some people...
Do others? Do others?
I think that the quotas are high, and I think that, you know, the inspections are sometimes pretty much just the gloss over, sort of a waste of time just to get the numbers.
Well, okay.
I really see the industry as a whole. I see it dumbed down, actually.
Okay, we're out of time, Debbie, but thank you so much for that wonderful call and appreciate it. When we get back, we're going to go to the six things Bill Marler will not eat, but I do. Oh, my goodness. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, 831-479-1080. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Oh, we do have so much to say in so little time. We're going to pick up James, who's tuning in from Pennsylvania on the Chipotle conspiracy. James, welcome to The Food Chain.
All right. Thank you, guys. So I wanted to comment on the conspiracy that you mentioned, that you don't believe in that, Mr. Marler?
No, it's not true. It's absolutely not true. I mean, I investigated every single one of those outbreaks in great detail. There was no conspiracy. That's just, it didn't happen. And there's no reason for me, you know, to tell you otherwise, other than just that's the facts. It's just the fact.
James?
So, would you consider the fact that there's huge money and powers behind Monsanto and the GMO movement to do anything and everything possible to, you know, influence in one way or another through dirty employees, through whatever it is, however, consider the possibilities.
It's not even, no, that's just not, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. And I'm sorry that you believe that, but it just didn't happen. These were all independent, you know, events caused by, you know, ill employee coming to work in the norovirus cases in two separate cities over a long period of time and, you know, bad food handling practices or contaminated tomatoes. It's just, you know, conspiracy theories I know are exciting, but that just didn't happen.
Okay. How about the fact that the food industry is not utilizing the most economical technology for sterilizing food is ozonated water in every single one of their facilities for food. I mean, that's so simple, and unfortunately, very few are using it.
Yeah, ozonation. Actually, there's a company here on the island that I live on, out of Seattle, and they do ozonation, and I've been to their facility. It's really very interesting. You know, even people don't like to think about it, but even radiation in some instances. Especially in spices.
Ooh, you know what flowers. I think about. You know what I think about radiation. Radiation is what makes fecal matter safe to eat. James, thanks for the call. Let's go to Steve. Where's Steve? Here, Steve. Is that you?
Yeah. Hi. I just want to ask the attorney one question. Do you work for Chipotle? Do they pay you any money?
No. No, 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 no. I represented the victims that they poisoned.
Okay.
I don't represent Chipotle.
Okay.
I don't represent companies. I represent people who get sick.
Yeah, but the thing is, earlier in the show, you said that somebody earlier years back made salmonella and went around and sprayed it on salad bars or something. So there's an instance right there from what you said that this type of stuff can happen.
Right, one time in the last 30 years that's happened, and it was a bunch of people in a compound up in Oregon that were trying to sway the election. It does happen, but once in 30 years versus, you know, what happened at Chipotle, the Chipotle conspiracy, it just didn't happen.
Well,
actually, it didn't happen.
Now, if folks want to know the things that you're not supposed to eat, raw oysters, pre-cut fruits and vegetables, raw sprouts, rare meat, uncooked eggs, unpasteurized milk and juices. Oh, shucks. Well, Bill Marler, thank you so much for joining us today. Always enjoy working with you.
All right.
And, you know, thank you for what you do to clean up our food, because I know you do have an impact on our food.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate being on.
Hey, well, thank you all.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.